It is Saturday, August 13th, 2011. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is Public Radio, KUSP. In the first half of the show, we'll be doing geek news with Ben. And in the second half, a discussion with screenwriter, novelist, and geek Ernie Klein. Ernest Klein's new book, Ready Player One. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme song is by Oingo Boingo, Dead Man Party, Dead Man's Party. Ben, do you even know this song?
Dead Man, yeah, good. I love that song.
Oh, good, good, good. It's actually in reference to Ernie Klein's book, Ready Player One, which we'll be talking about in the second half. It's full of pop culture, this book, I gotta say. I love it. And I won't goo over it as much when he has on air. But if you haven't gotten this book, you have to go get this book, especially if you like this song. But we do have geek news to talk about. So
I was just hoping we were going to listen to that.
We'll just listen to the whole song?
Yeah. Oh, it's a good song.
Boingo the entire show.
You know, after their farewell concert, Oingo Boingo's farewell concert, Halloween 1995, right? I remember like it was yesterday, right? Do you know why Danny Elfman is so resistant to the idea of doing a revival or something?
Why?
Hearing loss, damage.
He doesn't feel like he can.
Well, he said in an interview that he's probably genetically predisposed for hearing loss, but also like being on stage, that's a lot of noise, especially with a band like Oingo Boingo, you know?
So he's worried about his own hearing.
He's worried about his own hearing. Yeah. And do you know what Danny Elfman also does? He scores movies.
Yeah, lots of movies.
Tons of movies. Yeah. Like almost every Tim Burton movie you've
That's
ever
right.
seen.
I was just thinking Tim Burton and Danny Elfman.
I think there are only like five movies. Ever since he scored the first one back in the 80s, I think it was, for Tim Burton, he's only not scored like five of Tim Burton's movies.
It's
and you
so
know
funny.
How many...
It's so
movies.
Funny, Ben, this book, the Ready Player One, which I've had for like 3 months, but didn't want to do the interview until it's actually available. It's available like on Tuesday, because I hate that whole, you know, well, in 3 months from now, if you're not a publisher, you can read this. This book's now finally available. And the entire time I'm thinking, is everybody going to like this book as much as me? Because it focuses on this time period, the 80s, that I grew up in. And so I play, you know, Dead Man's Party right in the beginning, right to prep for the show. And you're like, oh, Oingo Boingo. I'm like, oh, okay. Maybe this is just universal. Maybe
all the jokes they make about me being young, I'm actually older than all of them.
When were you born?
In
the 80s, right? There you go.
But you know, Oingo Boingo was on until I was 10 years old. That's good enough, right?
Yeah, of course. Definitely. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe. He's a freelance media guy and sometimes Stanford instructor. Good morning, Ben.
Yeah, I just had my last day of instruction with Digital Media Academy on the Stanford campus yesterday.
And what were you teaching?
I was teaching web design that week.
Cool. So you're doing HTML, CSS.
Yeah, I had 15 teenagers. Strangely enough, 12 of them were girls, and that made the class really peaceful, like calm, quiet, zen. No, I mean, I wish I could say that everyone acts the same way, but I mean, and I'm not going to say it's intrinsic to gender. I would say it's, you know, that our society raises people differently, you know?
Yeah. So you were just doing a class on web design, and you do handle like table design and
table-based design.
No. Okay, that's an HTML joke. We'll go
on. No, actually, we covered, in 1 week, we covered HTML and CSS, the languages, because I'm not going to teach kids Dreamweaver without teaching them the language that it writes, because otherwise you just get really confused. So HTML, CSS, Dreamweaver, Photoshop, and Flash in
that's
1 week.
One thing a day?
Yeah.
That's cool.
It was incredible.
All right,
just sap up knowledge.
So I'm a little tired because, of course, I was staying up to look at the sky. And I had to do it like 4 o'clock.
Why were you looking at the sky, Lyle?
There were special pretty things falling.
You
want to talk about that?
Perseids?
Yeah, the
Perseid meteor shower hit its peak yesterday.
But it's still going on tonight.
It's still going on. Yeah, it goes on for several days. For about, actually, I mean, it depends on how you define it.
I've always thought it was like a three night window. But
yeah, but it can be a week or what. Yeah. It depends on how
patient
you are.
What's Perseids?
So yeah, basically they're called the Perseids because of the constellation Perseus, which is where they come from, and it's a meteor shower. So it's a bunch of little pieces of dust. Actually, they're little pieces of dust that have broken off of the comet. Comet Swift Tuttle is the name. So it should be called the Swift Tuttle shower, but because of our historical obsession with constellations and awe and reverence for them, we named it after the constellation. And the reason that it always seems to come from the same place, from Perseus, the constellation Perseus.
Okay, so there's a constellation because, Perseus. Okay, yeah, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I'm so not into it.
Have you checked your horoscope recently?
No.
No.
So there's constellation and these, why do they seem like they come from that?
Well, they're not actually, so most people think they're coming towards Earth from the constellation Perseus. But what actually happens is the Swift Tuttle comet orbits around and everything. And when it gets really close to the sun, little pieces break off because, you know, comets are largely made of ice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So kind of melts and everything. And so along the entire orbit of this comet, you have all this dust, right?
Right.
And once a year, around August 9th through 12th or 9th through 13th, the Earth passes through the orbit and hits all this dust. So it's actually the Earth which is running into the dust more than the dust coming towards the Earth.
Okay, and it just happens to be that the direction, if you in the giant curve of rotating around the sun, the direction the Earth is heading towards at that moment, the front wave, if you will,
worst meteor shower ever,
is the Perseids, the constellation Perseids. So it looks like it's coming. And it happens
because,
every year.
Yeah, because, I mean, you can look off in a direction, and that'll always be the direction of whatever constellation you're looking at.
Right.
You know, the stars that are really far away from the Earth, they don't change.
I would assume then at midnight is the kind of the most directional, that direction, right? Well, in sense that if it's at sunset or sunrise, right, then the Perseids are actually kind of on the horizon. And that's where the force of the...
I think it's a bit more complex than that.
They seem to travel... I mean, they seem to hit the entire way of the entire face of the Earth.
Think of it this way. If you have...
Think about this. Let's move on. Because I think we're both going to assume the same thing. You got a ball flying through and there's like a wake in the front and it's getting hit on that side.
From the perspective of the observer on the Earth, right? You look up in the sky and you see everything coming from right in the direction the Earth is heading, right?
Right.
But what actually happens is this dust doesn't just hit the Earth right on. It hits the side of the Earth or the edge of the, you know, different all around in a cone. So you have this impression that these are streaking away from the constellation Perseus, which makes it seem like they're coming from it.
Right.
And
actually, if it's coming straight on, you're not really going to see it very much because it's not going to have a long tail. It's going to have like
be like a flash of dot.
There was also a really large, bright thing in the sky that was disturbing.
Oh, I saw that. That was a UFO.
Oh, I thought it was a moon.
Oh, yeah. There's the moon.
Let's move
on. The moon makes it hard to see these things. So this year, you're probably not going to see very much until you stay up until like 5 a.m.
Right.
But next year, write it down. August 9th through 12th or whatever. Check it out. They're really cool.
Ben, in front of you, you've got a Macintosh computer made by a large corporation. How large, you might ask? Well, it's bigger than any other corporation ever.
What about ExxonMobil?
Apple is bigger than ExxonMobil.
What about
is the biggest corporation?
I ask the U.S. government?
Yes, it's worth more than the U.S. government. Even if you take away, the U.S. government's a negative value, I think, at this point.
No one wants
it. It's huge. You got some numbers on this. I mean, Apple's just immense. It's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, I've always thought of Apple as this tiny guy, you know, little guy moving forward.
So,
but it's not.
So let me just put this in a little context. Okay. So it's the middle of August. In the middle of July, Apple was worth around, at its highest, it was worth $375 billion. Okay. This month, they're worth $340 billion. Less. They're worth less. But ExxonMobil is worth so much less and they were the biggest player. So they've actually dipped below Apple for the first time. And this was the first day. This was August 10th. This was 3 days ago.
Yeah.
And the day closed and Apple had was valued at more than ExxonMobil.
It's amazing. I mean, I just think it's amazing because, of course, the corporation's not been around since.
Yeah, 15 years ago, it was broken.
It was gone. It was dead.
It was effectively dead. Adobe was like, no, we're not developing.
I guess Jobs is a really good CEO, huh?
Yeah, he's a good CEO. I don't know about a good person, but he's a good CEO.
I think he's probably. Have you seen?
I'm sure he's a nice person, but it really upsets me the way
Giants
he's run.
Giants of Silicon Valley? Have you seen the movie?
No.
No, I have.
They're Giants in Silicon Valley.
Isn't it called Giants of Silicon Valley?
I don't know.
I've never heard of it. It's a historical film to some degree. It's not really historical. It's a story of the makers. And
Yeah. I've seen a trailer for that.
Yeah. And clearly Woz comes off as this really wonderful guy, Steve Wozniak, and everybody else comes off as jerks. I mean, that's what I've affirmed. I haven't actually seen it. You and I need to see this.
And
this
of course,
is our commitment this week. We have to see this movie.
This week? Okay. Cool. You're planning my week.
I'm planning your week.
and of course, of all those people, the one person we've had on Geek Speak is
Woz, Steve Wozniak. Yeah. Nice one.
So we rock.
But to be that's fair, awesome. I've never invited Gates, and I've never invited Jobs and those other guys.
Good choice.
I haven't invited just Woz. And Woz is a blast. If you want to hear that interview, he's great. It's in our archive. You can easily find it online. In fact, you can find 11 years of Geek Speak on. Actually, I think you can only find since 2002. But we've been doing this for a long time. But let's move on to more fun things. Speaking of, no, I don't want to make that segue. That's lame. What's up with the theme park?
Wait,
thing?
Can you make the segue?
It was bad. I had to tie in my family and this weird esoteric thing, and it wouldn't have worked. Too much explanation.
Okay, all right. Okay, so I just want to talk about this particular Sikh named Hamad bin Hamdan Al Naya. I got it right. Yes. I just want to talk about him. I promise I'm going somewhere with this, okay? But he's one of those really crazy rich guys. So he's got 200 cars. He's got 7 Mercedes 500 SELs. They're painted in different colors of the rainbow, Roy G. Biv. He keeps them in a giant pyramid. He's from Jordan, right? So okay. the country of Jordan. He's built the world's largest truck. It's 8 times the size of the Dodge Power Wagon. Has 4 bedrooms inside. He built a motorhome in the shape of a giant globe, which is exactly 1/1,000,000th the size of the Earth. Like, this guy's cool. Crazy.
No, he's eccentric.
Esoteric. No, and really, really rich.
Eccentric. When you're crazy and have money, you're eccentric.
Yeah, I suppose so. Mm. But he seems like a good guy. I have one more interesting thing. He also has a private island, and he wrote the word Hamad, which is his first name. And it measures 1,000 meters high and is 2 miles long. He dug it in the sand. And he actually built it properly. So
he's got mad digging skills.
Water would actually flow into the H and the A and the M and everything.
This is a common thing on our planet. What are you talking about?
No, but like this is visible from space. This is like...
I mean, unlike the Great Wall of China.
No, unlike the Great Wall of China.
That's what I said. Unlike.
Okay. Yeah. He was also an extra on Star Trek Voyager. I'm not sure how he landed that, but probably has something to do with all of his money. There's actually a picture of him standing next to Rick Berman, and Rick Berman kind of looks like, you know, like one of those celebrities who's just tired of taking pictures, you know? And he's just like, okay, I'm taking a picture of the extra. Well, anyway, I tied in Star Trek there because he is just given the green light. King Abdullah of Jordan has given the green light to a $1.5 billion theme park, Star Trek theme park, Star Trek. Wow. That's going to be cool.
That's very cool.
$1.5 billion.
Where's it going to be?
It's going to be in Jordan. It's going to be in the...
See, now we finally have a reason to go to Jordan.
It's a coastal town. It's called Aquaba or Aqaba.
I know. I've been watching all the Voyager episodes and I really watched it.
I started watching them too.
Oh, it's so much
fun. I started learning German, so I was watching them with German subtitles. It's really difficult to learn German.
With English subtitles and German or with German subtitles?
German subtitles.
Just watching with German subtitles.
Yeah, but then I started watching with English subtitles in German.
Yeah,
actually I found was more useful. Because I started picking out words. DVDs and stuff.
Okay.
You know?
Crazy.
It's yeah. anyway.
So he's been on an episode of Voyager, and now he's making a Star Trek theme park, and he's got lots of money. And he's putting
$1.5 billion. So the people are going to build at Paramount Reaction, which I assume is a subsidiary of Paramount, who owns the Star Trek franchise.
Sure.
And the Rubicon Group, which I think is an awesome name. They're partnering with an architectural firm called Callison, and they're going to build this theme park. And I'm kind of excited. I don't know if I really want to go to Jordan, but maybe I may. I mean, maybe I'll find a way to go and interview some people in Jordan and go to the Star Trek theme park. But here's the coolest part about it. And I'm an environmentalist. I think this is awesome. All of the electricity at this Star Trek theme park will be renewable.
Wow.
Yeah, all of it. And they're also going to construct a center to talk about the importance and benefits of renewable energy sources and ecology and all of that.
Why doesn't he just start Starfleet?
You know, I was thinking that too.
Come on. Just start a
build the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah, come on, let's go.
In Jordan. Yeah, in Star Trek 4 when they fly the bird of prey down and you see the Golden Gate Bridge, that's actually in Jordan. they built a whole Bay Area just for that scene.
All right. Thank you, Ben, for that fantastic. You know, when you said you had a story about a theme park, I had no idea it was going to be a Star Trek theme park. That's just too cool.
I'm kind of excited. But talk about Geeky. Yeah, he's crazy, though. He's crazy. I don't know. I mean... Oftentimes I don't really know how I feel about people who have so much money that they do that. I mean, obviously he didn't dig a 2 mile long, you know, his name that's 2 miles yeah. long in sand. He didn't do that. He had a bunch of workers do that,
oh.
right?
Oh, I thought he did it himself.
No, he had one of those little kid shovels, the little plastic ones that always breaks.
He just took his really big truck and put a tractor scoop on it.
Yeah.
Just like did it in a day.
Flinging the sand behind
him. Let's move on to some more space news, but let's do some far out space news. And we cover a lot of like what's going on, but we don't talk about how we do certain types of science. And one of the topics that you seem to talk about a lot, Ben, is exoplanets. Like they've been discovered and a new one's been discovered and we have this great thing that discovers them.
Yeah.
We talk about this a lot. Actually, I was listening to an older episode where you introduced, Kepler. When you introduced Kepler on Geek Speak. But the one thing I was wondering if you could give us kind of a rundown a little bit, technically, how we do it. How do we detect these? I mean, we're talking small objects.
Yeah. So when you look out at the stars and you see a star out there, right? Just given the data that your eye gets, you don't really have very much information. You just know it's a pinpoint of light. But using all of these different methods.
And that it modifies your life, depending on where the sun is, the time you were born, right?
Okay, let's not go there.
Going
please. No.
So we don't know about. So there's a little point of light.
Yeah, we don't know anything about it. But then when we build all of these scientific devices and we use math and we use science and everything, we can figure out how far away these stars are. We can figure out what they're made of and all that stuff. Right now, probably many of our listeners have seen some kind of graphic at some point depicting the Earth and the Sun and the relative size. Right, mm-hmm. Earth is very very small.
Right.
Or if you want to say Earth is big, the sun is gargantuan and huge, right? The
right.
relative scale is just, it's so different.
It's actually commonly such a different size. You normally show Mars and then you show something like Jupiter and then you change your scale, mm-hmm. showing Jupiter really small and then mm-hmm. show the sun. And mm-hmm. it's like, wow.
It's one of those things that I don't think the human brain can really actually understand. We can understand it using numbers or math or whatever, but
okay.
I don't think
can. Then moving on. Next news story.
So it's just like ridiculously huge.
Okay.
So we've got these stars out there and we're looking for these planets around those stars. Now, those stars are so far away, they're difficult to see. We can't just point the telescope at them and see them, right? We need to infer all this stuff about them, like looking at the particular wavelengths and everything to figure out their composition, all of that stuff, right? So there are two ways that we've actually,
functional ways.
Successfully. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a third way that I don't know very much about. I can't remember, but the two ways we do it are one, we can detect exoplanets when they pass in front of their star. So we can see the star out there. And if the planet happens to pass between the star and us, then we can see a very slight dip in the light output.
Okay, well, that makes sense. That's just like if a long ways away someone has a house, a light, and all of a sudden there's a dark shadow real quick, you're like, oh, someone just stepped in front of that light.
Yeah.
And if it's up on a mountaintop, you can assume that the person the object that passed by is really close to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But
and the speed at which it got obscured, that makes perfect sense. Like that one's one of the ones.
Once again, though, the scale is ridiculous.
It's really hard to
like,
do.
Like, here's a metaphor. If you were in orbit, or like I'm not sure exactly to this metaphor, but it's something about like this metaphor that I read a year ago or something, talking about Kepler when it went online. But if you put a satellite in the Earth's atmosphere and you just pointed it at the entire Earth, right, and then you went on outside and you turned on your porch light, Kepler would be able to distinguish that difference in light.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So
that's
like,
amazing.
When we're talking about something that's just like a pinpoint size,
the descriptions
passing in front of.
Yeah, the descriptions I've had is if you've got the moon and in high orbit, you have a flea
mm-hmm.
and the flea goes between the moon and us. you can see it. It's like that kind of ridiculous, you don't even think that that's possible, but that's the kind of
scale we're talking about. But it's just like, it can somehow discern.
But that's a really lucky thing. We have to be in the same orbital plane, and the planet has to pass by while we're looking. I mean, and I'm assuming while we're looking is, it's going to take a while for the object to pass in front. So within the few span.
Well, consider that Kepler watches 10,000 stars at a time. So what it does is it just points to a star, it points to another star, it measures, it points to another star, it measures, and it goes and it eventually loops around, points to that star, and it measures, oh, hey, that's a little bit less than it used to be. So maybe it measures again, just to make sure that it's not a sensor error or something like that. And then it knows, hey, I'm watching that planet because something's passing in front of it, right? And we can actually discern not just one planet, but multiple planets going in front of it. And the problem is if we want to detect something that's something like Earth, right, with an orbit around one Earth year, around that star, we need to watch it for at least two Earth years because we need to see it pass in front of the sun once and then pass it in front of that star a second time
it's a really patient, Kepler's patient.
It's a really patient telescope.
Okay, so that's one of the ways we can successfully. The other way we successfully, we talk about the wobble. You always say it wobbles. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so imagine, I was having a conversation with a friend about this last night. Imagine you are, you're in some kind of frictionless environment. Maybe you're on ice skates or something like that. Yeah, I know. And so you and I are spinning around, holding each other's hands, and we're orbiting around that center point, or we're rotating around that center point where our hands are, right? Now, if I'm spinning around a young child, then I'm not going to be rotating as much. The young child is going to be rotating a lot more, right? Because they're less massive. Now, if you take a star and a planet, what's actually happening, we always think of the Earth revolving, or the Earth going around the sun, revolving around the sun. But it's actually that they're both are revolving around each other. In a simple system, you would say the sun and the Earth are orbiting around each other. Right.
Just the sun doesn't seem to move very much compared to the Earth.
Barely at all. But it does move, right? So if you have the sun and it's kind of wobbling around in this circle, right? And then you were to like stand really far away and look at this wobbling star, you would actually see it moving left and right, but you wouldn't be able to discern that. You would also be able to, you would be able to discern that it's moving toward and away from you, right? Yeah. And the way we can discern that is the Doppler shift.
Okay,
right?
We'll talk about that in a second. I want to talk a little bit more of describing this. If you take a rope, like a jump rope, and you put something kind of heavy at the end of it, and then you swing it above your head, and that, you know, swinging it above, you can kind of imagine that's like an orbit. If you notice your hand is actually going to move a bit as well. Mm-hmm. And that movement we're talking about is the kind of, you have to balance off the force of the thing orbiting you all the time. And you're going to wobble. Your hand's going to wobble a little bit. If you don't move it at all, it'll slow down and stop because there's no, the forces aren't in effect. Yeah, it will.
Oh, no.
You're making a scrunch face.
I agree with you. I don't know if that's the best analogy. If you take your same analogy.
You can do it with an object instead of visualization. You can actually do this
physically.
Well,
if you make a little change here, right, and instead of wiggling it or spinning it above your head, right, you're holding the jump rope tight against your chest and you're spinning like that.
A heavy object.
A heavy object. Then you actually are
take a 3-year-old and grab their hands outside the lawn and then spin around. You'll notice that you're moving a lot, too.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, you're not like rock solid standing in one place,
right?
You're Superman or the Incredible Hulk.
That's true.
You know, comic book movies, physics doesn't apply.
Okay, so the planet around the star is causing the star to move back and forth and in every direction towards you and away from you, assuming, again, you're in the plane or partially in the plane.
But now, I said you can't put a telescope at this thing and see that small of a movement, right?
It doesn't move very much.
We can't see solar flares, really, of those, right? Okay. We can detect them, but we can't see them optically like you would look at Saturn or something. But we can, using the Doppler shift, we can determine how fast it's moving toward or away from you, right? And so, you know, as an ambulance passes by you, the sound gets deeper, right? It starts do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do like that. Same thing happens with light. And so as something accelerates towards you or accelerates away from you, the light actually shifts a little bit red or a little bit blue. Blue if it's moving toward you because the wavelength is higher, and red if it's moving away from you. So we can measure that Doppler shift, infer the movement of the star, and then infer the movement of the planets or the mass of the planets.
Doesn't that mean that we have to know really well what the mass of the sun, the star is?
Yeah, but we can usually infer that by looking at its composition.
Okay.
Right? So like
brightness.
Yeah, if you burn helium and then you burn hydrogen, they're going to make slightly different shades of color. But if you take that and you run that shade of color through a prism, it'll spread it out across, let's say, a piece of paper, and you'll see all of the red at one end, all of the blue at the other end, and the green and the yellows in between. And you'll see these sharp lines. And if you look at those sharp lines, that's what's that called, spectroscopy?
Yeah.
I can never say that right the first time. if you look at that spectroscopy, you can infer how much of different elements are in this this star. And then, therefore, you can look at the composition and infer its weight or mass, I should say. So anyway, it's kind of crazy stuff, but it's really interesting to see how often Doppler shift is important in our observations.
It's used a lot, yeah.
Yeah. So those are the two ways, and science is awesome. That's all.
And the composition specifically, every material that emits light when you excite the electron jumps back down to lower orbit. That's a very specific color that gets emitted.
Exactly.
And so you can see the fingerprint, if you will, of every element. And if you have a whole bunch of elements, like a complicated system like a star, you can actually split them back down to the primary elements and then also notice the shift. It's really kind of cool stuff.
One last quick thing. What amazes me, though, about this is like when you take all these principles, you get some pretty simple data back. But what really amazes me is how scientists can take this data and actually figure out, oh, this system, based on its wobble, has four bodies in it. One is about the size of Jupiter. One is about the size of, you know, Earth. One is about the size of Mars. One is super, super small. Like, it's just really cool, this crazy multivariable equation, and they can just solve it all with science and math.
It's too cool. Thank you so much.
Too cool.
Our guest today is Ernie Klein. He's the author of the wonderful book, one of my favorite books of the decade, I would say, Ready Player One. Ernie, thank you so much for joining us on GeekSpeak.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you know what? I've got to plug one thing in, and we don't have Ernie yet. Sorry about that. You can hear us, but we can't hear you. Thank you, Ben. Please.
So, exoplanets.
Exoplanets. Very cool stuff. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now. Thank you so much for joining us. So, Ready Player One, you described as a Willy Wonka as a game developer instead of a chocolate maker. Can you get in a little bit more about that?
Well, that was just kind of the initial idea. I grew up with a lot of really enjoying a lot of Roald Dahl's books, and Willy Wonka was a big influence on me. And I always loved kind of the story of the eccentric billionaire who has a contest where he kind of does whatever he wants. And so that was the initial idea. But I'd worked in like IT and doing like really nasty tech support cubicle jobs for many years. So I spent a lot of time helping people with the internet and also thinking about, you know, the future of the internet and watching the internet evolve. So I kind of had those kind of two ideas at once, kind of imagining the future of the internet and then picturing this kind of Willy Wonka video game designer who would have a kind of a virtual reality treasure hunt inside this futuristic version of the internet. And everything, you know, the whole idea and everything in the book kind of grew out of those initial ideas.
Right. We're having a little bit of banging sound of your microphone. You might be hitting a cable or something. If you could try to make sure that doesn't happen.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and do the, you mentioned your kind of remedial jobs prior to becoming the famous writer that you are. And I love this about the author that Crown has sent over with your book. Ernest Klein has worked as a short order cook, fish gutter, plasma donor, elitist video store clerk, and tech support drone. His primary occupation, however, has always been geeking out, and he eventually threw aside these promising career paths to express his love for pop culture full-time as a spoken word artist and screenwriter. His 2009 film, Fanboys — you are the author of Fanboys, a fantastic film — much to his surprise, became a cult phenomenon. These days, you're living in Texas with your wife and a small child, and kind of taking a ride with this book. I get a lot of books from publishers for GeekSpeak. I rarely do them because the amount of volume that I get is hard. So when Neal Stephenson releases a book, I read it. You know, I have these people that I love that I'm going to read, and especially if I can get them on the show and interview them. And I specifically got a call from someone who I know that works at Crown and said, you have to read this book. And so when I got it in, I read it cover to cover. And then I was in this frustrated place of, you know, you get the books 3 months before they're out, right? I couldn't talk to anybody about it, you know, because I mean, I could talk to them, but they couldn't read it. You know, I had one copy, and I'm like, ah. So I was like, I've got to get this person on. But I can't do this to all these people. I've got to say, let's postpone interviewing you until I can say, you know, Tuesday, go buy the book. So now the book is coming out on Tuesday, and I'm assuming you're extremely busy with these frantic book tours to get it all over the place. Are you enjoying this aspect of it? Are you enjoying the writing aspect more? What do you like about this new world that you're in?
That's hard to say. I have, I mean, so far I have been kind of going around and promoting the book and meeting booksellers and kind of going to things like Book Expo America and the London Book Fair. So I'm getting even though the book's not out yet, I've already kind of got a taste of what being a published novelist is like, especially at this level. So it's really kind of overwhelming. I mean, I've been dreaming of being a novelist since I was a little kid, and I spent a long time working on this book off and on between screenwriting projects. And now, now the book's finally about to come out, and, I've had a few experiences of doing signings and stuff, mostly for librarians and booksellers and things, but it's just kind of amazing. I mean, I kind of had this experience with fanboys, but that was only Star Wars fans,
right?
You know,
right.
Of which I am one. So I kind of that was a different experience. Whereas this, I'm just getting kind of an amazing reaction from all kinds of people. At first, I thought there were just a lot of geeks in the bookselling world and sure. Librarians, but
I've been thinking about this book for months, and of course, the podcast I listen to, people have interviewed you and I've heard a lot of interviews. You came to Santa Cruz, actually, and was interviewed by Rick Kleffel here in Santa Cruz about your book. And the entire time, I've been kind of like, how am I going to do this? You're going to talk so much about the book. How are we actually going to talk about this book without covering the exact same topics everywhere? And of course, with the internet, you can go and listen to the amazing interview that Mark Frauenfelder did with you with Boing Boing's podcast, Geek Week, or you can go listen to the Agony Column, which is a show here on KOSP, and listen to those and have a wonderful interview about the book. So instead, I thought what we'd do is we talk about pop culture of the 80s, because one of the wonderful things about this premise of this book is that the rich genius who has this treasure hunt grew up in the 80s, same time period as me, and I'm assuming you as well, and loved that culture. And so when the treasure hunt occurred, it's all based around that time period. So we have a futuristic society which is studying the 80s. The theme song I used in the beginning of the show today was Dead Man's Party by Oingo Boingo. That plays in pretty quick in the early book. I was wondering if you'd be interested in telling me, when did you first hear Boingo? Did you go and buy an album? Was it on a CD?
Yeah, you could say I was born in 85. Describe the 80s to me, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I was kind of listening. I grew up in a really small town in central Ohio. It wasn't even really a suburb of anything. It was kind of a small factory town. It was really isolated. We didn't even get MTV because the local churches had boycotted the cable. We would threaten to boycott the cable company if they'd carried MTV because it would be a bad influence on there. It was like the town from Footloose.
Right. Totally.
Yeah. So I felt also kind of isolated, but also I, even in this small town, I had access to all of the television shows and a lot of the movies and music and everything that everyone else in the country. And even, I'm discovering all over the world kind of American cultural imperialism, spread our culture by the 80s, everywhere. So people who grew up, the guys who are publishing my book in Norway have told me that they grew up with all the same, all the same stuff. And that the references, really speak to them, too, because their childhood was very similar. So yeah. The 80s, I guess the question is about Oingo Boingo. I had listened to a lot of mainstream, music of the mall, whatever was on my local radio stations. And then when I was in, I think my junior year of high school, I started dating this girl who was, she was alternative, and she had all these tapes in her tape case that I'd never seen, bands like the Violent Femmes.
Exactly.
And she introduced me to all this music, and that was when I discovered Oingo Boingo. It was her favorite band, and I just fell in love with them.
Right. Me too. Girlfriend introduced me to Boingo and Violent Femmes.
Me too, actually.
Yeah.
I love what it. Would we do without the girlfriend?
Exactly.
I would just be listening to Rush primarily still, probably, if it wasn't for her.
Well, and that's
I'd be
not
listening
bad either.
To Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh, there you go.
That too, yeah.
My first concert, Weird Al Yankovic.
Mine too.
Really?
Are you serious?
Was it in Santa Cruz?
No, it was in San Diego.
Yeah, he did
at SDSU.
All right.
I never knew that.
Your book is full of these wonderful pop culture references, and they're the thing that's great about them is they're extremely subtle. So unless you know really well what it is, you're not going to get the reference. But when you do get the reference off of just nothing, like a name or something of a character, it feels very personal. Was that intentional? Did you say in the beginning, I'm going to put as much in here as possible? Or were you just, as you started creating, did you just kind of go down this rabbit hole of history and memory?
Well, I think part of it was my experience making Fanboys. I had written Fanboys as also kind of this outpouring of my inner geek. And then over the process of getting the movie made, I just saw one after the other, all these great references that I thought were hysterical and these situations, just studio executives and people, you know, in a position to make decisions didn't get any of them. And so that one by one, they totally got stripped away. And, you know, which is hard for people who watch Fanboys to believe that, you know, it's not nearly as geeky as I intended, but it wasn't. Like a lot of, you know, a lot of the like little subtle stuff like that, that I thought was great, that that doesn't telegraph the reference, where it's like, hey, everybody, this is a reference to something, you know, where it was just subtle. And if you get it, you get it. And if you don't, you don't. And I saw all that get stripped out of Fanboys, and it really was frustrating to me. And that was a big impetus for finally finishing this book, because when you write a book, there's nothing between you and the audience. And I knew that I could geek out as much as I want. And if somebody didn't get a reference, that doesn't matter. It's still, you know, I'm still keeping it in there just for me. So I was really just trying to please myself. And I love books that kind of acknowledge the existence of all of pop culture. I hate it when characters kind of live in a world where they don't have any of the, yeah, the same pop culture stuff that I do, because that's so much a part of my life. And the way that I talk to my friends is riffing on pop culture. And it's, you know, part of our language. You can totally make yourself understood a lot quicker by, you know, referencing all this stuff that all of us have grown up with. And it, you know, it forms an instant connection with people because they had all the same stuff that they were growing up with too. So that was what I wanted to do with the book. But even, you know, as I was writing it, I didn't know enough about copyright law or know, the publishing world to know that if this book could ever even be published. It was a story that I wanted to get out, and I wanted to write it the way that I wanted it.
There's a lot of freedom in copyright in a novel space, right? It's almost never, plagiarism, of course, is totally frowned upon, rightly so. But in reference to corporations and things like that, it seems like the novel space is very, I think it's probably because it's such a well-defined art form that it's very hard to attack it. Unlike a video, you know, taking a sample of a commercial from Coca-Cola and putting it in a movie of yours, that can be a problem without the right rights. But on a novel, you can quote anything you're experiencing, because, of course, you're describing something that you've experienced, and right off the bat, that has a totally different space and copyright. But you're also working, I mean, right when the book was released, the next few days, you got this slurry of competition to make the film, to get a company to do the film. And now I'm assuming, recently finished the screenplay for this book. How are they going to tackle this giant, like, are you going to be playing episodes of Family Ties in the background of the scenes with Wade? You know, how are you going to do that?
You know, I don't know. That was my first question. How are they going to do this? You know, because I wrote this book really just to please myself and also with kind of the distinct idea in my head that it could never be a movie. Like and I was writing something, you know, with the specific idea in my head, I'm going to throw off all these, you know, restrictions of screenwriting and write a book and just have fun with the story and do whatever I want and never think about it being a movie. So
I think that's essential for great art, right? You've got to just do it for your own love. Because if you focus on the profitability of it, be a realtor. You know, I mean, there's other things to do if you're trying to make money. And that love really does show up. We're talking with Ernest Cline. He's the author of Ready Player One. We are discussing the book. It's out on Tuesday. My favorite book of the decade so far. I love this book. I highly recommend picking it up, especially if you're around the same age as me. And you probably know, if you are or not, if you're following what we're talking about, if you know what Family Ties is, you're probably set. You were going to continue that sentence, though. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just need to put that in there.
I totally threw you off.
It's okay. Well, we're just talking a little bit about, you know, doing it for your love and not having the copyright restrictions of film kind of structure how the book might be.
Right. Yeah. And the problem with like adapting Ready Player One for me was when you mention a song in a book, you're just, you know, saying the title, which is fine. But in a movie, if you want to reference a song, you're actually physically reproducing it like a piece of art or a movie. And that was kind of one of the first things, you know, I was kind of dreading. I was both incredibly excited because I wanted to write, you know, a movie for a big Hollywood studio. And this is Warner Brothers. And I grew up, you know, watching Warner Brothers movies and cartoons. And now I'm getting to go on the Warner Brothers lot, you know, and have, you know, talk to them about making my book into a movie. But I was also dreading it because I knew, you know, just from the nature of the book that they were going to want some really major changes. And I had no idea, you know, how we were going to tackle it. So that was like a 6-month process of figuring out a way to reference all this stuff without showing it or showing it in a way that doesn't, you know, violate copyrights or just changing it. Like you can't have, like, even though, like, I was really excited because Warner Brothers owns Blade Runner, and Blade Runner plays a big element in the story at one point. And I thought, oh, I could, you know, we can use all the Blade Runner stuff. But it's not even that simple. Even though, you know, Warner Brothers owns Blade Runner, you still have, you know, you need to get the permission of Ridley Scott and all these filmmakers. And there's all this. So I don't know. It's kind of a nightmare, actually, trying to adapt Ready Player One in a book. But
so what are you doing? Are you pulling those references out, or what are you doing?
Some of them, you know, it was kind of a fight, or maybe let's say a give and take between me and the studio. I'm like, well, this, you know, because one of the things they said was really going to have to scale back the 80s references. And I'm like, yeah, that's the whole book, you know, like, what did you guys buy?
It's the futuristic 80s. Come on.
Yeah. But what Warner Brothers loves about Ready Player One is they see this big kind of futuristic virtual reality treasure hunt in a world where anything is possible. So you have kind of a high stakes treasure hunt, but you can have these amazing fight scenes and amazing scenery. Yeah, yeah, like Inception. You know, I think
you can have the guy in full plate mail and the megathon, you know, robotic creature and the laser gun. Like all of it fits in the same scene, no problem. That's the book is amazingly good about being able to provide that. But at the same time, I look at high figure, you know, blockbuster movies and go, ugh. You know, I mean, some of them kind of do it right sometimes, but lots of times the book is just so much better. You know, I mean, Ben and I were talking a couple weeks ago about the Harry Potter series, you know, and I love the movies that came out. They were really a lot of fun, but they didn't have the depth that the books do.
Yeah, you have to cut out so much.
You've got to do weird things that in your mind's going to fill in stuff that makes your, you know, that covers certain details. It's just not going to work the same way. And I'm worried about that. I mean, I remember talking to Gibson when we interviewed him for one of his books and about the movie industry and trying to make, like, why isn't Neuromancer a film that's, you know, awesome? And there's a lot of these kind of old school authors who went down the film path and just got so jaded. They're like, that's not my space. I don't want to be there. And you kind of came from the opposite direction, right? Your first success is a film, and then you do a novel. But are you letting go of too much? Is this going to break this story?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, that was something that by the end of the process, I was like, all right, I'm ready. I'm done. I'm ready to be done working on this, because I'd been working on the book for like a year and a half solid before I started on the screenplay. And the screenplay was like starting over at the beginning and kind of reimagining it. Right. And it was very exciting. I mean, because I can see this, you know, I can see the movie in my head, and, you know, having a chance to, you know, try to make that happen with Warner Brothers is amazing. But you always have to compromise. And like you guys said, the book is always better than the movie, because the book plays out, you know, in your imagination, which is the best, you know, movie screen possible. And there's never any worries about, you know, budget restrictions, and the line delivery by the actors is always perfect. You know, everything is the way that you want it to be when you read a book. Right. Whereas in a movie, you've got to visualize all of it.
I'm imagining that they have to do it as a very high budget film, right?
They want it to be, you know, like they're like an Avatar or one of their Harry Potter movies, like a big budget movie that they sell all over the world. And that was part of the problem too. Like Warner Brothers, they're the biggest movie studio on the planet, and they make a lot of their money from their films overseas. Mm-hmm. And so so this book that's kind of mired in American pop culture and very specific to kind of our, 1970s and the 80s and all of that, I wasn't, you know, sure if they could, they weren't sure if they could make that work in a way that would appeal to people all around the world. So it was really kind of a Kobayashi Maru writing situation where, here, you know, this is an impossible task. Go for it.
I thought you were a Star Wars fan, not a Star Trek fan.
You're the first person aside from me who's ever called something a Kobayashi Maru in my experience.
that can't be.
That was
one of the things about Fanboys that got changed, that it didn't necessarily make me happy, was this kind of showing this non-existent animosity between Star Wars and Star Trek fans.
It's like, you know, NorCal and
SoCal. It doesn't happen. And one of the most exciting things about me in Fanboys was getting to be in a scene with William Shatner. I got to be an extra in the movie, so I got to be in the scene that William Shatner's in. That was one of the most exciting things for me. And then people are like, "You hate Star Trek, huh?" And I'm like, "No, I'm, you know, nuts about Star Trek.
I'm so glad to hear that, because the whole negative aspect of the Star Trek characters, you know, the animosity and the actual, like, the bad guys of being the Star Trek versus Star Wars. Definitely that exists when you're all hanging out chatting and somebody says, I'm taking the stand that Star Wars is so superior, and everybody else in the room is like, okay, well, what about this? And there's like a fight. But that is completely, any of those people can reverse their positions, right, and take that same argument the opposite direction, because we love it all.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I don't feel it. I mean, there are some guys who are in, you know, their Star Wars camp or their Star Trek camp, but those guys are idiots. I mean, the people who, you know, like, appreciate good storytelling and appreciate, you know, awesome stuff, I think you're going to love elements of both Star Trek. I think it's like Elvis and the Beatles, you know, you always love one more than the other, depending on your personality and your taste, but you can appreciate both of them.
I found if you know more about Star Trek, then you're going to be a Star Trek fanboy, and you're going to dislike Star Wars more, and vice versa.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. If you know a lot about both of them, then in my experience, at least my friends, they're, you know, kind of cool.
Okay. Ernie, most important question then. Phaser or lightsaber? Which would you prefer?
Phaser or lightsaber?
Or William Shatner's fist,
I think.
Lightsaber?
Yeah, even though it's not a ranged weapon and you know, maybe not as many options, it's cooler.
Yeah, double lightsaber or single lightsaber?
Also, your favorite book, Snow Crash, right? And the protagonist has a sword. So you've got to have that kind of...
Yeah, samurai sword.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely.
First, I want to... We're not covering the book very much, and there's a few different reasons. One is that this book is really awesome. You got to go get this book. So now the audience knows that aspect of it. I'm a fan of it.
Thank you.
And I can't express how much you'll enjoy this book. But I think the best way to do that is to quote Mark Fehrenfelder, who is one of the guys I interview, and he's great. He runs Boing Boing, one of the founders of Boing Boing, and is one of the contributors. He places it, I'll summarize what he says. In the 1970s, the book that blew his mind was To Your Scattered Bodies Go by Philip, I don't know that book, so that was kind of fun.
Philip Jose Farmer.
Thank you so much, and I haven't read it, I gotta read it. 1980s Neuromancer William Gibson, the 90s Snow Crash Neal Stephenson, and in the aughts, he said Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. I gotta agree, that's a really great book. That's wonderful. Of course, that's written by a friend of his, Cory Doctorow, so I don't know if that's trustworthy. But in the teens, it's your book, it's this book. So if you liked any of those books, you're gonna like this book. Okay, so let's stop about the book a little bit, and I'll talk about some of your inspiration. Why did you like Snow Crash so much?
Well, I think it was just like the audacity and you know, the smart-ass tone of the narrator. Or it's just like the from the first sentence, that book just like grabs hold of you and has an attitude, and then just a nonstop amazing stuff happens. There's, you know, there's this amazing virtual world that at the time seemed like you know, exactly what I wanted the future to be. I mean, that was, I think I read 92 or 93, and before the internet had hit big. It was ARPANET, yep. I think, still then. And so that was just all, and I'd read Neuromancer, but Neuromancer wasn't really written with like a programmer's eye to detail. The way that like Neal Stephenson created the metaverse and the Snow Crash, it just seemed
totally real.
It felt real. And like right down to, you know, the way it would run on its servers, you know, it really, and part of that is, you know, he's a programmer and also an engineer and a genius and a brilliant guy. So all of that kind of came across, but just the story, it had this great rock and roll, you know, guys on motorcycles with nuclear bombs strapped to them and like hackers wearing samurai swords.
Hacking the human brain. Yeah.
I know.
It's great.
You know, with like mental viruses and giant, floating, ramshackle cities, all of it. It's just an amazing book. And I know a lot of people have problems with the ending and other elements of the story, but I just loved the whole thing, the beginning and the end. And that was one of those books that I would just like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series that I would just revisit, you know, just because I adored them so much.
Yeah. Okay. So you've got a 3-year-old, I think, right? And
it's true.
Yeah. What are you going to do? How are you going to, I have kids as well. And luckily my kids enjoy a good book. But it's always curious to me where you introduce what kind of content. Like, for example, for your daughter, are you going to show her episodes 1, 2, 3 of Star Wars, or are you going to show her 4, 5, 6 and then let her go back?
Yeah, I think I would show her 4, 5, and 6 and then she can decide to go back if she wants.
That's what I've done too.
I'll leave that up to you. I don't know, like it's the introduction, like when do I introduce my child to certain things thing is kind of tricky, I'm finding, because like my daughter's already become, like I grew up loving Ultraman, this Japanese superhero Ultraman, and watching that show, and so there are all these Ultraman toys around my office, and like my wife and I had Ultraman and Ultra Woman like figures on our wedding cake. And my daughter found these toys and asked about them, and then started playing with them, and then I swear to God, it was not my influence. She just became obsessed with Ultraman and wanted to watch, you know, and now she like sings Ultraman Japanese theme song. She doesn't even speak Japanese, but she'll like sing the theme song in Japanese. Like she just gravitates towards like whatever she's interested in and then becomes fixated on it just the way that I did. So I think you kind of like, I think I'm just going to step back and let my kid, you know, freak out over whatever she wants to, you know, is attracted to, as opposed to trying to create some sort of super geek with through experimentation and exposure at different phases.
I would say if you want to go the Star Trek route, don't start with the first movie.
Yeah, well, that would be bad.
God, it's horrible.
You know, I tried starting the kids on the level, so I tried Next Generation, and I started with the you know, 2-part pilot. It's not very good.
No, it's No, it's like, okay.
The cue comes, there's that weird mesh screen thing. And it's yeah. like, what? And then
yay,
there's like
CGI.
No exact plot exactly. It's like, we're having an argument.
You know, the first time I mean,
but
saw...
But it's important, of course, because you know, when you get this entire series, it's very important that Q is there because he's at the end, you know. But that's just a totally different perspective.
Yeah, the first time I saw the first movie, the first Star Trek movie, which is really long and has excruciatingly long visual effects shots, the one that I actually saw was the director's cut.
Oh,
the
yeah,
one
yeah.
with an extra 26 minutes of footage. So they flew around the Enterprise 5 times before docking instead of 1.5
with
times.
With all that intense music.
Oh, God. Anyway.
Well, they'd really done a nice job of revamping the Enterprise.
Oh,
they
yeah.
wanted to show it off. They
oh,
wanted
yeah.
you to have a good look at the model.
They were the filmmaker Scotties. And then they had the real Scotty there. Really proud.
We're talking with Ernest Klein. My name's Lyle Troxell. Ben Jeff, he's also here with me in the air room. Ernie's in Texas. We're in Santa Cruz. We're talking about his book, Ready Player One. It's a novel. It's a futuristic flashback to the 80s to some degree. It's a fantastic read. I can't recommend it highly enough. And Ernie, I want to thank you for writing this. One of the things, of course, with a good book that's very difficult is when you put it down, you just want it to start again. So I did start reading it to my 9-year-old. And every time he goes to sleep, I read another chapter forward and realize he's asleep. And then the next night I have to back up. So I'm reading your book in this weird repetitive style that's kind of
Memento
making
style.
Me insane. So I got to figure out a way. I think maybe I'll have him read it directly. But Ernie,
Are you skipping over the swears?
No. You know, swearing's part of our culture. I don't mind the swearing. And nothing in your book is, you know... It's nothing that's, I think it's a 10-year-old, no problem. I mean, you know, the movies that we see are much more violent. I don't really have a problem with sexual explicit material if it's not insane. And there's not much of that in the book anyway. I think that's a fine book for a 10-year-old, no problem.
Well, that's good to hear. Does he all the references are to?
He doesn't understand the reference nearly as much, no.
No? Yeah, he doesn't care.
No, but it's still a great story, right? I mean, it's a young guy who is in a horrible society and world and escapes and, you know, it's a lot like Willy Wonka. It's got that magic to it. And anyway, yeah, go on.
No, I was just like my favorite review so far is by this 15-year-old girl in high school who runs like a book review website as like her hobby. And even though, you know, she's 15, she, you know, has no idea about the 80s, but she still really dug the story, and that just, you know, that blows my mind. That's
yeah,
like
that's
the coolest
wonderful.
Thing. Yeah.
That's totally wonderful. Ernie Klein, thank you so much. Again, the book is Ready Player One. Ernest Klein, thank you for joining us on GeekSpeak.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Take care, Ernie.
Bye.
GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Cruzeiro Internet, offering computers, quiet drop-in office space with a 10 gigabit fiber internet connection at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is at cruzeiro.com. Friends of County Animal Services sponsors Placing Animals with Seniors, a nonprofit program that matches pets from Monterey County Animal Services shelters with seniors aged 60 and older. Information is available at 769-8850. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. We will have everything we talked about today on GeekSpeak up on the GeekSpeak website, including a link to the show and probably a link to a couple other books that I mentioned today. If you're interested in the kind of topics that we have for today's interviewing authors, things of that nature, or if you want to have a suggestion for us here at GeekSpeak, we'd love to hear your feedback on the show, on the content we provide, or any kind of geek news that you hear throughout the week. A lot of what we talk about comes from a lot brighter geek audience, our listeners. Thank you for listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell, and Ben Jaffe joined me as well. Thank you, Ben, for being here.
Thank you.
See you next week.